Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock with this week's selection of highlights from members of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. You'll find all the shows at laborradionetwork.org or use the hashtag Labor Radio Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
You know, I'm not just the epithets that they give me. We shape history every day, and collective actions here could shape history in a new way.
Cristobal Cavazos on Immigrant Solidarity DuPage on Labor Express Radio, Chicago's only English-language labor news and current affairs radio program.
My Pietro, he worked in the sheds for 15 years. Always he was not satisfied. Always he said someday he would find other work. But no other work he found.
That's from the latest episode of En Masse, where interdisciplinary artist, labor activist, and political educator Liz Medina brings together oral histories and social theory with stories of struggle and hope from the working class. Plus, Sheet Metal Sisters share their stories, Worker Beat votes by mail, UCOM Live reports on unemployment claims in New Jersey, and on labor history and two, Chicago's first teacher's strike. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices. First up, in the latest episode of Talking Smart from the Sheet Metal Workers Union, we hear from members of the Smart Women's Committee. This first clip is from Lisa Davis, a Local 16 member out of Portland, Oregon. The second is from Vanessa Carmen, a trustee and leader at Smart Local 66 in Seattle, Washington.
We're not here to diminish anybody else, but to lift us up to a level that's equal and equitable.
Through the years, I bring a different perspective that nobody at the table can bring. Not only am I a woman, but I'm still currently working in the field. I have sisters come to me with issues or problems, and I can actually address them and, hey, these things are happening out there. Like, how can we fix them? How can we make it better?
Lisa Davis and Vanessa Carmen on the latest episode of Talking Smart, Sheet Metal Sisters share their stories. Lisa works as a field rep at the Sheet Metal Union's International Training Institute. On the Talking Smart podcast, Lisa shares her unique journey to becoming a sheet metal worker and instructor, which included stops along the way as a bowling alley mechanic, microbiology student, bar cook, coffee farm worker, and assistant in an open heart surgery trauma unit. She addresses the importance of mentoring and female role models in the trade and the need for the union sheet metal sector to continue to diversify if it wants to expand and prosper. Vanessa is a trustee and leader at Smart Local 66 in Seattle, Washington. On the podcast, she talks about how she got into the trade and what it was like apprenticing and entering the union sheet metal industry after working for non-union contractors, harassment and discrimination on the job, and her work helping to connect and advocate for women in the union through the Smart Women's Committee. You can find Talking Smart wherever you listen to podcasts or, of course, on our website, laborradionetwork.org. Next, we go to Dallas, Texas for a quick visit with Workers Beat host Gene Lance, and then we'll jump to New York City where UCOM Live host Chris LaGrange talked with New Jersey Department of Labor Commissioner Rob Angelo about how his state is handling the record surge of unemployment claims.
Tell me about your workforce at the Department of Labor in New Jersey.
Thank you for the question. Like any employer and any workforce anywhere, the beginning was a very anxious time for everybody, not just in our offices, but, you know, people concerned about their families, their kids in school and their elderly parents, wherever they were. Mm-hmm. And then also, at the same time, everybody in this department, like Department of Laborers and basically all civil servants everywhere, know that they are working for a broader mission.
Yeah.
And folks in this department especially are used to dealing with people who are dealing with a stressful time, whether they're unemployed for a non-COVID reason, or they're looking for training, or they have a disability, or they have new workers' comp. We are attuned to dealing with the public, the working public, generally, when they're having anxiety in their life. But I think this is the first time that, as a whole, that everyone in our department is also dealing with that in their own life.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be more proud of the efforts my staff put in, whether it be the folks who work directly for me, the folks out in the UI call centers, the folks in our one-stops everywhere, and quite frankly, everybody's just become one DOL. Because anybody that can find a phone number anywhere for this department, they're calling it, they're emailing it, because they need some kind of help. And we're all sort of blended into one helpful family right now, mostly on the UI front for sure. But we're now losing sight of our duty going forward to train our workforce going forward. But, you know, we had to deal with that like everybody else. We had some positive cases in our workforce. We have 51 offices across the state. So we had to take all the proper measures in those offices to protect their coworkers, to protect other departments' workers in those places, to protect our customers. So it's definitely been a crazy time, but one that I couldn't be more proud of our great staff, our great CWA members, our great IFPTE members, our great ASME members, our great IBW members across the state to make sure that they know that they're keeping themselves safe.
I'm encouraging you and everyone else to make a statement. Sign a petition at least, or what's better is to make an actual video in your home with your home computer and let me circulate it. Send it to me, Gene Lance. You can reach me at genelance.org. Genelance.org. And Lance is spelled L-A-N-T-Z. So send me your videos and your audio statements in favor of vote by mail for all Texans, and I will help circulate them all over the internet. This is Gene Lance doing the Workers Beat Extra.
That was Workers Beat and UCOM Live. You can find both shows wherever you listen to podcasts or on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Next up, Labor Express Radio is Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs program. This week, they highlighted the work of Immigrant Solidarity DuPage and their Workers' Center, especially their mutual aid efforts during the COVID-19 crisis.
You're listening to WLPN 105.5 FM Chicago, and you're listening to Labor Express Radio, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for and by working people. I'm your host, Jeremy Lucero, and this is the Sunday, May 17th, 2020 edition of Labor Express. On tonight's episode of Labor Express Radio, we continue our now nearly 2-month-long examination of how unions and social movements are responding to the COVID-19 crisis. One of the groups that was quick to organize mutual aid in response to COVID-19 was Immigrant Solidarity DuPage. I've wanted to have them on the program for some time, as I've been impressed by the success and tenacity of this relatively small group of workers in the secluded West suburbs who have established a much-needed and successful worker center. I now have that opportunity. We'll hear from Cristobal Cavazos, who will not only talk about their mutual aid efforts, but about the history of his group and the importance of worker centers in general. Immigrant Solidarity DuPage formed in 2007, inspired by the 2006 May Day mega marches that returned May Day to its home of its birth, emboldened the contemporary immigrants' rights movement, and gave a boost to the labor movement all at the same time. More recently, the organization, which has from its beginnings addressed the concerns of immigrant workers and their struggles on the job, formally organized a workers' center, a type of workers' association that does not have the same collective bargaining power of a traditional union, but is also freed from some of the limitations and restrictions placed on unions under U.S. labor law. Cristobal Cavazos is one of the founders of Immigrant Solidarity DuPage, and he explained how the excitement of May Day 2006 convinced him of the need to organize immigrant workers in the underserved suburbs where he is from.
I was in my 20s, you know, and I had never seen anything like those mega marches there. I remember Halstead Street and Ashland, just the flooded. I never seen so many people in my life going there and then actually taking part in organizing. You know, I went on to start to go to Chicago from, I was living in Glendale Heights where I grew up, and going to Chicago and taking part in that movement. And we just knew that we had to come back here to the suburbs. Again, you know, I grew up here, that we had to form a radical movement out here in defense of the community and in defense of worker rights.
Right. And like I was saying before, too, it's we don't focus enough on what's going on in the suburbs. And I think people have an idea in their head of the suburbs as a place that's filled mostly with white middle class people, these kind of, you know, middle class homes and, you know, white picket fences or whatever, you know, idea they got in their head. And
No.
Right. They don't, you know, realize that there's a large working class, a very diverse working class out in the suburbs. I mean, Will County, which is just, you know, to the south of you guys in DuPage, that's the one of the largest, I think it's considered the largest inland port, where they call, you know, basically it's a complex of warehouses and rail yards and so on in the middle of the country, where it's the hub of the logistics industry. And so there are just hundreds of thousands of people in that industry, and then all these ancillary industries. I mean, it's a real hub of working class activity that people don't realize.
Yes, it is. Yeah, Elk Grove Village, you know, Elk Grove Village has a huge industrial park, and, you know, you could, every factory and warehouse you could imagine is there in Elk Grove Village. So we're very, you know, West Chicago, we have the industry, and as you're mentioning, around the Romeoville and Joliet area, it's the second largest concentration of warehouses in the United States after New Jersey. So we have a lot of workers out here, a lot of workers. And I ended up here kind of by chance. You know, my parents were actually farm workers. They were migrant workers. My mom was born in South Texas, a Tejana, you know, a Mexican-American born in Texas. And my dad was from northern Mexico. And they came up here to Illinois for the first time. They were picking sugar beets in Danville, which is an agricultural community south of Joliet and Kankakee. They were picking sugar beets. And actually, the first time we came up here this far north, my parents were picking cucumbers in Joliet. So we kind of got here, you know, to paraphrase Langston Hughes, you know, the suburbs were never the suburbs for me. You know,
Right. Yeah. What a classic story that is. I mean, that, you know, again, people don't, I think, realize how much of farm labor there is in the Midwest. You know, the Midwestern states are a real hub of activity for farm laborers as well. And then again, a lot of that farm labor then oftentimes migrates into the industrial sector in the Midwest. So I think your family's story is the same, you know, is a story for probably millions of other Latinos.
Yeah, you know, the migrant workers, you know, because you have the Latinos that were from the railroads, you know, you have some dear brothers and sisters. We have an activist out here, Steve De La Rosa, that he came out here to his family to work in the railroads. You had the meatpacking plants. But yeah, we're the branch from the farm workers, and they came up here in the 60s, actually, and settled down here when my father was able to find a job at the Dominick's. You probably remember the old Dominick's company, the food company. He found a job at the warehouse in Northlake, a local 705, a Teamster, and, you know, given that job and given his union, you know, his union membership, they were able to send me to college. You know, we were able to buy a house. So, you know, we kind of got a little bit of our stake out here, given the union, my father's union membership. And that really just took us out of poverty and really just itinerant labor that my family had been doing.
Right. So the organization is called Immigrant Solidarity DuPage, and I know there's different facets of the organization. A big part of it is the worker center. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And we've started the first worker center out here in DuPage County. It's 3 years old, and we have an active committee of about 12, 13, 14 people. We meet every single week on this, and we knew that we had to do a workers center early on in the group. We started the group in 2007, and you know, to struggle for immigrant rights, you know, to change minds, to be a watchdog out here for Latinos. But the first calls that we started to come in were almost maybe about 70% workers cases. And I remember in particular, one of the first cases that we took in the group was with the Steak and Shake restaurant that had sent out no match letters to the company. And I don't think in those days none of us knew what a no match letter was. So we had to go learn quickly, you know, I was in my 20s, and we launched a struggle there, fighting against that company and protesting there. So we kind of knew that our activism was going to be taking a different direction early on in the group. And we went ahead and we studied with our dear brother, Jorge Mujica, with Martin Unzueta, Tim Bell, who I think he's done incredible work over the years in Chicagoland, that was one of the influences of us. And so we went on, and 3 years ago, we declared ourselves an official worker center here in DuPage County.
Great, great. And the worker center movement has been just terrific at reaching out to workers that have just not, unfortunately, had the opportunity to have unions represent them, have not had that, you know, traditionally been organized by unions and so on. I'm curious, though, have you guys also been able to develop relationships with more traditional unions as well?
You know, not as much as we would like. And I think it's kind of like one of the realities is that, you know, when you're in the suburbs, we're in the DuPage County, I think that union life is just so irrelevant here. You know, you don't meet anybody that's in a union. You don't see anybody that's in a union. Yeah. Well, the people out here that are in the union, you get the carpenters and, you know, a lot of the more established workers out here. But as far as our base, you know, the factory workers and the warehouse workers, we rarely come across many unions. I mean, we've met some people, the UE, Carl Rosen and Mark Meinster. We've struggled with them from years ago, so we're friends with them. Armando Robles from the Republic Window. But aside from them, and maybe like a few interactions with SEIU Local One that's been out here, you know, it's really not been a part of the Latino life out here, the unions. And this is really where we've had to be that organization. We've had to be that working. We have to take the calls. You know, we have to lead people on in strike when they want to do that, and file the cases of wage theft, and you know, kind of go back and start to. I really like the worker center movement because you really almost are going back to their roots. You know, we've been studying syndicalism, for example. We've been studying the Enrique Ricardo Flores Magón, two great Mexican anarchist and syndicalist, and going back and looking at some of the IWW stuff of the past and tactics that to use on the workplace. So we're really trying to see a revival here of what you might call like a new kind of syndicalism, you know, that, you know, when you're in the Latino community out here, when you have no documents, you know, you're pretty much, we just feel like we're behind enemy lines all the time here. We found a lot of solace and inspiration in how much power we have as workers, you know, that we give the wealth and we create the wealth, but we could also take that wealth away. So we've been publishing a lot of pamphlets on going on strike, on the value of workers, and how much labor, how much value we create out here in the suburbs. We really want the working class out here to know their value, you know, to have this consciousness that I am a worker. I'm not just what they call me, you know, I'm not just the epithets that they give me, but, you know, we are a value force here, and we shape history every day, and collective actions here could shape history in a new way.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. I think not only do worker centers fill a niche that traditional unions haven't been able to do, like you're saying, of reaching workers and reaching communities that have been left behind by the traditional labor movement, but they also are actually returning the labor movement to its roots. I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think your examples of the anarcho-syndicalist movement, of the IWW and so on, are perfect examples. I don't know if you want to, if there's any other cases or examples you want to highlight of some of the past work that you've done as a worker center.
So we've been, you know, essentially there's a lot of what you would call, what you see with wage theft out here. I didn't know that there was as much wage theft as there was until the calls have just, you know, ever since we started the group, they're taking on wage theft. We have a case that we are just settled with the NLRB of a case of some workers who got a no match letter. They had received it last year, and we were fighting against the boss not to fire them because these are workers that had been in it's a factory in West Chicago. They'd been there over 20 years. A lot of these workers are in their 50s. And so we organized these workers because they came to us and like, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to get fired at Christmas time. And so we brought them in here to Casa DuPage. We formed a workers association. I think it's a beautiful thing when workers form associations, because as we know with NLRB laws, when there's two or three workers that are united, you're essentially working as a collective unit. So we brought them into a collective unit and we struggled, man. We protested this place. We did press conferences. We did call-in campaigns, you know, whatever we could throw at this place, fighting these no-match letters, which have really been, I think this has really been our major case that we've done out here is lately, at least, is fighting these no-match letters. Just this idea where in this particular factory, you have an owner who buys the company. You had this old boss who had been around for years and who got along well with the owner. This new owner comes in and his immediate thing is, you know, we're going to cut costs here. I know that people don't have a document here, so we're going to go and send them these letters here and just use this as a convenient excuse to just scrape away and shave off 25 workers. And they had already been getting the workers that were there to start to train temp workers to come in and take their place. So we felt this was a complete outrage here. We organized these workers, we protested here, and we took this all the way to the NLRB. And, you know, we've taken this a lot farther than we thought that it could. And we just reached a settlement with these workers last week. And I think that kind of shows what, you know, some of the things that we can do. Because I think before we started Immigrant Solidarity Page out here, and particularly the Worker Center, I think a lot of workers were just resigning themselves. You know, this is the United States. We're going to get screwed over. You know, I'm a first generation immigrant. I'm just going to sacrifice my life. So I love that we've been able to come in and create a lot of fronts. You know, that's kind of our goal. In all of these warehouses and factories that we see in West Chicago and Addison and Elk Grove Village and Bolingbrook here, we're trying to set up little fronts. And with these fronts here, you know, with the information, with the consciousness, with the access here, with what we do, which is bringing people together here, kind of see these fronts as like the seeds of a transformation of the whole place. Because what we would really love to see is a complete regeneration and reforging of the syndicalist movement, the labor movement here, forming unions out here. And in these unions, you know, giving people that are just expendable workers, you know, permanent, making the bosses out here. You see extreme wealth in the suburbs. You see some wealthy people in the Hinsdales and in the Elmhurst here. Just people have more money than you could imagine. A lot of these factories and warehouses, the bosses are there in their luxury cars here. So we know there's an extreme imbalance of wealth here, and we see the Casa DuPage Worker Center really on a revolutionary path of forging a new equality out here, in getting the rich to pay their due and giving the workers to get their due.
Well, Cristobal, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Your energy and enthusiasm is infectious, and it makes me hopeful for the future.
You know, I really appreciate it, my dear brother. I send you a big abrazo and stay strong.
That's all for tonight's program. Labor Express is a nonprofit 501c3 member of IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers, not those of the IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Committee for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. The songs are theme was called Worker Songs, written by Ed Pickford and recorded by the Dropkick Murphys. Tune in next Sunday at 8 p.m. for another edition of Labor Express.
Labor Express Radio, news for working people by working people. Labor Express Radio airs every Sunday at 8 p.m. on WLPN in Chicago, 105.5 FM. We've got a link on our website, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that began the first strike of the Chicago Teachers Union. The strike lasted 3 days, but it won teachers a $100 per month pay raise. The school board also agreed to hire 750 more teachers to help ease the overcrowded classrooms that plagued many Chicago public schools. Some of the most important victories of the strike came for black teachers. Prior to the strike, many black educators in the city could not find full-time positions. Instead, they were relegated to a permanent substitute status. In order to teach full-time, the teachers had to pass an exam. The exam included an oral portion. Often the testers would fail black teachers who had moved to Chicago from the South. They called these teachers' Southern accents unprofessional. The oral exam became a way to bar black teachers from advancing to full-time status. In the years before the strike, black educators were organizing around this issue. They also demanded changes to the school's curriculum to better include black history and literature. These black teachers did not gain much support, even from their own union. They began to organize sick outs to demonstrate their commitment to these changes. One result of the strike was an end to the discriminatory exam process. After the strike, the school board agreed to include more African-American content in the curriculum. The teacher's strike had shown the power of the union. Over the next 20 years, CTU would stage 9 more work actions. Some lasted only 2 days. The longest was 19 days long. In 2002, the Chicago Teachers Union again went out on strike, recalling their historic fighting spirit. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
If work couldn't be found in the formal job market, people would often find or make work for themselves in the informal market, which is often criminalized. During the heydays of the granite industry, widows of deceased workers supported themselves and their families by running boarding houses or making and selling food, wine, and spirits. This week's episode of the En Masse podcast brings the story of one such worker to life.
Melichenda's oral history was recorded by Mary Tomasi as part of the Federal Writers Project. It was likely recorded between 1936 and 1939. During the Great Depression. Jenny Blair will be performing Melichenda's story.
I'm getting dinner ready for a party of 12 people, all from Montpelier. Not Italians. Italians know how to make their own Italian dinners. These Americans. In the winter, I get about 2 orders a week for good-sized dinner parties. In the summer, not so many. They like to get out then in their cars and stop at different places to eat. Always they want ravioli for their dinners, and some want spaghetti at the same meal. Me, I think it is foolish to have both at the same dinner. They're almost the same, except that the ravioli are stuffed. But if that's what they want, me, I don't care. It means more money for me. I've been doing this kind of work for 10 years or so, since my husband died. Quite a few women in Barrie earn money this way. It's a funny thing. In Italy, I was always too busy to think much of food. I lived in the Lake Como district up north. Our house was on a hill outside the city. My 2 sisters and me would go to the city every day to work in the mills. Silk mills. We were so hungry at noon, we were satisfied with any kind of food. We carried our lunch with us. Polenta and cheese tasted as good to us then as chicken does today. We liked good food, but we were always too busy and didn't have enough money to eat. Over there, it seems funny to be cooking meals for people who got no more money than me. It's in the last 10 years that American people have been asking for Italian food. Many Italian women have machines to make these raviolis. I haven't got one. They're quite expensive. And anyway, I'd rather make them by hand. They look better when they're made by machine, but they taste the same. We always made them this way in the old country. We never had any machines to help us. Our fingers were the machines. I never saw the machines until I came to this country. I came over when I was 18 years old. I wasn't married then. I came over here to marry Pietro. I grew up with Pietro. I went to school with him. We were always good friends in the old country. He came over here to work in the sheds. Every month, I got a letter from him. He told me how good the granite business was. He asked me to marry him. So I wrote back, yes. I came over here in August. I liked Barrie. It didn't seem strange to me. We were married right away, and right away, a great many people came to visit me. Italian people. Not many I know, but all Italian people from the north of Italy who spoke my Italian and lived the way I lived. I had no time to be lonesome. My Pietro, he worked in the sheds for 15 years. Always he was not satisfied. Always he said someday he would find other work. But no other work he found. He caught a bad cold one winter. The doctors, they all said his lungs were already weak. Couldn't stand the added sickness. He died. Well, I was with four children, all young enough to be in school. So I said to myself, you gotta earn some money, Melicenda. You gotta earn a little money to add to the insurance money Pietro left. So I started to cook meals for these American people. They like Italian food, and they pay good money for it. It was work I could do at home. So I tried to get as many orders as I could. One Italian woman, a friend of mine, does the Italian cooking for one of the restaurants. But me, I don't want to bother with that. I got enough to do. I got one girl in her last year of high school. I gotta keep the house for her. The other three children are married. The boy is in the printing business in Boston. And the two girls both live outside the state. They were both married before they were out of high school 3 years. I'm glad for them. They got nice homes, and they're happy. I'm happy they didn't marry stonecutters. Always with them, it is worry, worry. Worry about their health, and worry about how many days a week they work. No matter how good-looking a man is, or how good he is, I never would say to a girl, marry him, this stonecutter. No. Less than 20 years I had with my Pietro. That is too little.
That was Jenny Blair performing Melicenda's story. Jenny Blair is a freelance writer, editor, and MD. She has contributed articles on science, medicine, and culture to a wide range of publications, including New Scientist, The Washington Spectator, and The Hartford Courant. Despite many differences, Jenny did find a lot of parallels between Melicenda's world and her own.
Melicenda lost her husband Pietro to what sounds like a lung ailment. And I don't know the statistics, but I know that silicosis is a menacing disease that affects people who work with certain kinds of sand and stone and other materials. And I sensed from her story that he knew that his work was hurting him, that it was injuring him in some way, and that he worried about it. And I guess this is, again, something that in some ways has not changed. There are people who are stuck in industries that are harmful or living in places where the air pollution is so bad that it sets them back and sets their children back. So there is that public health angle to this that is really tragic. I am guessing Pietro was very young when he died, probably only in his 40s. And that's horrible. And he was doing it to create granite, which is, if I'm not much mistaken, somewhat of a luxury item. It's unfortunate. Melicenda is a freelancer. She looked at her monetary situation. She thought about what she could do. She assessed the market and she went into business for herself. She doesn't have a boss. She doesn't have controls or protections. She doesn't have the security of a pension or a steady paycheck. But she has a kind of freedom that, for example, her husband did not have working where he worked. She can work from home. She can control her environment. That's all familiar to me. I'm a freelancer as well. I've been doing it for 10 years. I work from home as a writer. I set my own hours. I'm my own boss, and I can tell you my boss is a real jerk sometimes. A lot of women of color, of course, have been doing this for a very long time, working outside the home, earning money for their families. And Melichenda, as an immigrant, was faced with the same necessity, and she rose to the occasion. I think she's a badass.
The En Masse podcast, where interdisciplinary artist, labor activist, and political educator Liz Medina brings together oral histories and social theory with stories of struggle and hope from the working class. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts, and we've got a link on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Last up, we've got a real treat put together by Mark Gavart, who hosts the My Labor Radio podcast out of Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Hey folks, it's Mark, your host on My Labor Radio. You can find us on multiple podcast platforms, and this show is now part of the laborradionetwork.org. You can discover more than just us by visiting their website. The Labor Radio Network will help you find your next new favorite union podcast or radio show. A simple network of folks from across the nation. Working people keep raising their voices more and more each day and demanding better treatment from their workplaces and their elected officials. As you know, these voices don't get heard very much on the corporate-controlled media. But the 21st century's labor movement has a new way to get its message out there. And working people don't rely on traditional media gatekeepers. It's now the internet, so you can turn off your TV to get the real news. So that gets us to that one-stop shop. Just visit laborradionetwork.org. On the main page, you'll see a grid of show logos. Just click one, and the description and links pop up right there. It's worth going to visit this ever-growing Voices of Labor resource. Join us at laborradionetwork.org.
That was Mark Gavart, an auto worker who hosts the My Labor Radio podcast out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Way to go, Mark. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. As always, thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed these highlights from labor radio and podcast shows around the country. They're part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, a growing family of nearly 50 shows that focus on working people's concerns and issues. We've got links to all the network shows, laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local radio podcast show. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly is produced and mixed by me. Our social media guru is Harold Phillips, and you can always reach us at laborradionetwork.org.